Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Wouter Hendricks. I'm a software architect with Nice Software. Today I'm going to talk about some new stuff in Entity Framework, namely the CTP5 about Code First Entity Framework. So as an overview, first I'm going to review the existing Entity Framework programming model, probably how everyone is used to using Entity Framework. Then afterwards, I'm going to introduce the code-first way of doing Entity Framework domain modeling. I'm going to talk about configuration of the new code-first approach. And then afterwards, I'm going to show some example usages of the Entity Framework code-first. And then as a last step, I'm going to talk about some special things we try to do to set up a special domain model using the CTP5 for Entity Framework. So first I'm going to talk about what I call classic entity framework. It's the way how everybody is used to using the technology. And I want to discuss two approaches. First approach is the model first approach, where you start from the EDMX file and build everything from there. And the second approach is the database first approach, where you already have a database or you want to construct a database first and then continue from there. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about what I call the most traditional approach. Is the way everybody is used to, or at least learns to use Entity Framework first. At the left I show a small EDMX model from which you can generate a database, so SQL statements to create the database tables, from which you can create the entity objects, for which Entity Framework out of the box already offers three flavors. A simple POCO objects, you have the self-tracking entities, and then you have the entity objects, which are the default, which are automatically generated from your EDMX model. Of course, in this approach, it's even possible to write your own T4 templates for generating different stuff out of the EDMX. For example, you can generate views if you want, in fact, you can generate anything else. So what are the advantages of the model-first approach? Well, first, of course, you have a visible representation of the model, which can be a great advantage, because then you at least you have an overview of what you're working with. And then second, you have a wide range of options for generating your entity objects. The three things I mentioned, the POCOs, the self-tracking entities, and then the entity objects. And then third, a database can be constructed from your entity model, requiring no extra effort from your side. So some negative points is that it's tied to the EDMX file format. So you do model first. So the first thing you do is construct your EDMX model. We encountered some issues in the past regarding scalability and sometimes composition of such models, which I'm going to talk later, an extension of existing entity objects in the model by subclassing, which is also something I'll talk about later. And then a minor drawback of the EDMX approach, at least as I see it, is that you have a duplicate representation of the same information. You have your domain model represented in your EDMX and then again in your entity objects themselves. So it's a minor drawback. So to talk more about the EDMX file format, it's designed as a XML format to describe the mappings between database tables and entity objects. And it's designed with great flexibility in mind. Now, I don't know whether you already tried to edit the file manually, but to my experience, merging such files if you have different branches or even trying to modify something by hand is far from easy. So the way I see it, the EDMX is just a storage format for the visual diagram you get. And it could as well have been a binary format. I don't see that much advantages of editing it. Furthermore, there are some complications if you want to address larger models or do the things I mentioned before, like cross model references or extending existing entities in a separate EDMX file. So for larger models, the picture shown there is just the upper left corner of a domain model from a business application we've been working on. like arrows indicate there's much more of that if you scroll to the right or to the bottom. So from this, I just want to show that the EDMX domain model, if you use the designer, it's a great tool to visualize the relationships between the different entities, but as is, it's difficult to use it for more complex domain models. So a solution you might naturally want to adopt is to use multiple EDMX files. Now, at first that sounds like a good idea, but as I'll demonstrate, it's not always always the best approach. Well, mainly because, well, the way EDMX was designed and was intended to be used is to have one database coupled to one EDMX file describing the entities, and then together with one object context which will be used in code to manipulate the entities. So if you want larger models, actually what you really need is just one EDMX model coupled to one database, one object context, but you just want to do the diagramming in a more straightforward fashion. So what people have been working on is the improvements for the entity designer, in which colorings can be applied to entities and multiple diagrams can be constructed. So for example, if your object model has several entities related to addresses and persons and companies and stuff, you can just put them in one diagram and have them colored blue, and then you can just construct another one for products. And if you have overlap, you can pull in one of the blue entities just to create the navigation properties. So this is not yet available in Visual Studio right now, but it's something they're working on. So I was talking about cross EDMX file references before. Now, if I mention, well, you don't need that, you just want one EDMX with multiple diagrams, then why did you mention cross EDMX references? Now, we had some use cases in the past where we really wanted to do those cross EDMX references. And for example, well, the most important one was, imagine you have a sort of software framework already built and packaged in a binary distribution. Well, of course, the framework will have an EDMX model with several entities in there. And then you're building an application on top of that framework. You just import the binaries, you use the binaries, and you have no way of interfering or interacting with the existing EDMX inside the framework binaries. So what you want to do is actually construct your own EDMX model, but then create on top of that links to entities from the framework or subclasses from entities from the framework. Now, okay, so those are the two main reasons you want to adopt this approach. The obvious why not is that you're interfering with the internals of the framework. That could cause problems regarding security, validation, consistency, several rules that are enforced inside framework code, which you don't know of or which you bypass by importing part of the framework's model inside your software. So the second traditional approach I mentioned in the beginning is the database first approach. So at the left, I depict a database. From the database, you can generate your EDMX model, and then from the EDMX model, just like in a model first approach, you proceed generating the entities and possibly all kinds of other stuff you might need in your application. So as I see it, the database first approach is mainly used in a legacy setting where you already have your database in place and you want to build an application or port an application on top of that using entity framework. What you'll do then is generate EDMX from the database. Tables will be converted into entities. Primary key constraints will become entity keys. Foreign key constraints will automatically be converted into navigation properties and so on. That way you can build up your domain model starting from your database, and it's a valid alternative for adopting the model first approach. So now we get into the real stuff from CTP5. I'm going to give an introduction about the code first approach at the start, and then we'll delve into some code using the new CTP5. CTP5 was released in December 2010, December last year. That doesn't mean that the code first actually started then. The previous CTPs have been working on a code first approach for entity framework as well. Now, I just read this morning on a blog post that the planned release for the CTP5 is still scheduled the first quarter of this year, and that will call it Entity Framework 4.1, at least the release candidate. So what is it about? I've drawn a small scheme at the bottom of this slide. Actually, at the left, I still depict the EDMX model, which is optional because, well, as the name suggests, we're going to use a code-first approach. So at the center, there is the code describing the actual entity objects, which can either be generated from the EDMX, that's optional, or you can just provide it yourself. Or, of course, generate it from something else if you really want to. Now, from the code, you have the option with the CTP5 to automatically let the database be generated and automatically from the code construct the navigation proper to the navigation and do the column mappings for you. So what is the advantage of this? The main advantage, in my opinion, is that you just write a code describing the entity. So you just say, well, I have a person and a person has an ID, which is a GUID, and it has a name, which is a string, and so on. And I can just offer that to the CTP5 code first entity framework. And it says, well, database table names and column names and all these things, I'll take care of that for you. You don't have to specify those yourself. On top of that, apart from the sensible defaults the code first approach offers, you still have the option to configure everything where you like to deviate from the defaults. So the downside, I see two downsides. Well, the main downside when you're not using the EDMX to start from, so you start from pure code, is that the information about your entities and about how they're structured and related to each other is embedded in the code files themselves. So if you want to get an overview, you'll have to use some other diagramming tool to generate a class diagram of how the different entities relate and how they talk with each other. Now, when you do start from an EDMX, you have the reverse effect. That is, you have the EDMX from which you generate the entity classes, and then you have the entity classes, and at runtime, you're not actually using the EDMX, so you have sort of a duplicate information stored. So I'm going to give a small demo where I'll just create some objects in Visual Studio. I'll have the database generated by CTP5 without really interfering with the sensible defaults. And I'll just go to the SQL manager to have a look at what database was created. So for the data model for the demo, I just created 5 entities. We have a bar at the left, and at the bar, there are several cocktails served, and a cocktail has several ingredients, which is the cocktail part entity, and an ingredient consists of a certain fixed quantity, like one small glass, and then a component, which can be, for example, a sort of liquor. So I'll just quickly open my Visual Studio and then go through the code related to this example. So as you can see, I created a folder POCOS, which, for example, if I open the bar entity, it's just a regular class, nothing special. It has 2 properties, one for the GUID, the ID, and one for the name of the bar. And then I created an iCollection of cocktail, which I call cocktails, which is nothing more than just a regular property in the class. Please note that I've created it virtual because CTP5 would like to do some internal proxying, which wouldn't be possible if I just made this a regular method. So if I then open a cocktail is just a regular class. It has an ID. It has a cocktail name, and cocktail name is defined here at the bottom as a complex type. Just using the complex type attribute, the CTP5 code first will pick up on that and embed it as a complex type object. I have a virtual collection of cocktail parts, a virtual collection of bars, which is actually the reverse of the relation I mentioned before. So the cocktail is served at a set of bars. And then I have a display name property, which only has a getter, which just says cocktail and then the name. And I flagged it as not mapped, meaning if there's no no corresponding database column related. And then last but not least, there is the code first context, I call it, which inherits from DB context. DB context is HTTP5's alternative for the classical object context, which will do all the tracking and stuff. So in the DB context, the only things I added are the DB sets, which are equivalent to the object sets for bars and cocktails. So now my main program is nothing fancy. What it does is it says, well, I need a new context. And in the context, I ask to create a new database if it doesn't exist. So if I quickly run that, there will be no output. So if I go to the SQL Server Management Studio, quickly refresh my databases, you'll see there's a new database created with the name of the project and then the name of the context. This is also a default. I didn't specify anything. There are several tables. For example, if I open the table for the bars, you'll see it automatically created some columns. It creates a column ID as a primary key, which I also didn't have to specify. The CTP5 just picked up on the fact that it was a GUID and it was called ID. So that one would probably be the private key of the table. There's the name. Then if I close bars again, you'll see you'll have the cocktails, which if I expand the columns, the ID is there, the name is there. Notice that the display name, the not map property, is not present here. You'll see if you look at it, most tables correspond to entities, except for this one. It's the cocktail bars. Now, what does that table do there? It's actually just the mapping table for the many-to-many relationship. As you'll see, it just consists of two columns, the cocktail ID and the bar ID, which together comprise the primary key for this table. And then you'll also see that automatically two foreign keys are defined, namely the relationship with with the bar entity and the relationship with the cocktail entity. So all of this stuff and the naming of the columns and the naming of the database tables have been generated automatically without me interfering just a bit with the sensible defaults. So if we go back to the slides. So the first thing I'm going to talk about now is the configuration part of the code first approach. I've demonstrated before that a lot of things are done by convention. So, for example, the main reason behind this is that the code-first approach wants to offer you a way of working where you just define your entities and then start from there. Everything has sensible defaults. Now, that's more than logical because, for example, the bar entity, the entity is called bar, so there's no reason to deviate from that naming for the table name, which would be bars. And then CTP5 code first spots an ID field called ID in your entity. It's more than logical to use that as a primary key and so on. So a lot of things can be deducted from the way you defined your entity objects in code. And the CTP5 will take it from there unless you want to deviate from these defaults. Also, the database creation is something you don't have to worry about yourself. If you want, like I did in the example of the demo, you can just say database create if not exists, and your database tables will be there automatically. So for configuration, you have several options. You have two options. Either you go through the attributes or you go through the Fluent interface. Attributes are things you'll just interweave with the code you have. So for example, you can annotate your primary key with the key attribute. You can specify column names to your liking. And there's the inverse property attribute. which will be used to specify which navigation property points to which. So for example, I have the cocktails property of the bar entity, and I have the served at property of the cocktail entity. So they both point to each other. If you have multiple relationships, for example, between the same two entities, you would want to use the inverse property attribute to specify which points to which. So I already demonstrated the not mapped attribute, which says, well, don't include this property in the database. Then there's a table attribute to specify a table name. You have a complex type attribute to let the thing know that this class is a complex type or should be embedded as a complex type. And then you have a timestamp attribute. So this is just a piece of code where I've added those attributes to the cocktail class. And there's nothing really fancy about that. I just tried to use them all in a bit of an artificial example, certainly with the complex type there in between. But it just shows that you just have your entity code, and in between you add those attributes to deviate from the default configuration the code first approach offers. So the second configuration option is to do it in code through the Fluent interface, which will mean that inside your DB context, you'll have an extra method, or you override an extra method on model creating, which is passed a model builder on which you can specify special deviations from the sensible defaults. In that, you also have like two options. So the Fluent interface will allow you to customize the database mapping and also deviate in several forms from the sensible defaults offered by the code first approach. So as an example of the usage of the Fluent interface, I've just tried to map one of the many to many relationship between the bar entity and the cocktail entity in code in a way that deviates from the sensible default. So there I say, model builder, give me the configuration information related to the bar entity. And then you can just chain a set of method calls to do the configuration. So for example, I say, well, the key of the bar entity with the hashkey method, I say the key of the bar entity is the ID property. You can also, you use lambda expressions there instead of strings to make it even more, to make it easier to specify those configuration properties. Then I say, well, a bar has many cocktails. And then I say with many, which means the other end of the relationship is also a many site. So this means this relationship is a many-to-many relationship. And then I say map, I get a configuration object. And on that configuration object, I can even specify what the name of the left key is. So the key of the bar that is involved in this relationship, I say what the right key is. I can even specify the names of the columns in the many-to-many mapping table. And then also give the many-to-many mapping table a special name, as I did in the last statement. Well, this slide just demonstrates some more options you have for the Fluent interface, which I suggest you can look at quietly. I'm not going to read everything on this one. So the second extra approach for configuration that the CTP5 offers are configuration conventions. We already mentioned several of those, which are all automatically implied by just using the thing out of the box. It's like you have a naming convention for table names, which is just entity name with the S added. You have several others which are just configured by default. Now, if you want your own, the code first approach offers you with several options, or with an option to plug in new conventions. Now, what I try to do here is that, say, at your company, if by default or if by convention you have to prefix all your table names with the word table and then an underscore, you can tell the CTP5 to do that for you automatically without having to add table and attributes to each of your entities. So what I constructed there at the bottom is a iConfiguration convention, which has an apply method. It gets passed a type and then a function which will return you a configuration. And what the only thing I do here is I say, well, this entity, well, because it's an entity type configuration here, this entity should be mapped to the table called, and then I add a prefix and then just the name of the type. Here in the onModel creating of the DB context, I just set up the entire thing. I say model builder conventions add, and then the name of the convention I just created. And then on top of that, what I did was I removed the other conventions which are related to the table name, because they interfere with the new thing I try to add here. Because the other conventions already say, well, you have to pluralize the entity name to get a table name. And now I say you have to prefix the entity name to get the table name. So I want to override the two others. So doing so, you'll see that instead of using the standard names, the names of my database tables are now just table underscore and the name of the entity, not pluralized, just singular. There's only one anomaly in this picture, is the cocktail bar table, which is still just named cocktail bar. Now, why is that? It's because that one is not really a table corresponding to an entity. It is the mapping table on a many-to-many relationship. And that one doesn't, well, the convention I just specified doesn't apply to that one. So now I'm going through some sample usages of the objects and the object and the DB context we created in the demo before. So first, it's interesting to reiterate the entity state enumeration. Well, inside entity framework, you probably know the entity can have 5 states. It's added, unchanged, modified, deleted, and detached. Now, I try to depict them a bit grouped together here. There are 4 states, all except the detached state, where the context knows about your entity. And then there are at least 3 states in which the entity actually resides inside of the database. So added means the context knows about your entity, but the entity doesn't exist in the database. Unchanged means the context knows about your entity, it is in the database, and how it is in memory is still the same as how it is in the database. Deleted means the context knows about your entity, it's in the database, but you want it out of the database, so on a save changes it will be removed. And modified means it's in the database, the context knows about it, and some properties have changed, or the context knows about changes in some of the properties, which is not entirely the same. And then detached, if an entity is detached, the context doesn't know about it, and we don't know either whether it's in the database or not. There's no information, and that's why I just draw it on the border of the in the database box. Now, if you want to do manipulations there, you're always going to use the same pattern where you say using, or where you use a using statement, and then just construct a context which will be disposed of once the block goes out of scope. And in between, you can do stuff with your entities and manipulate them. So as a first example, I'm just going to demonstrate how you can set the state, and I find it very instructive to go through the entry method of the context instead of using the DB sets, because if you go through the entry method, it's quite obvious that you're setting the state of the object, while otherwise I could have set, for example, context.bars, which is the DB set, and then .add, and provide an entity. Then also the state of that entity would be set to added, but I think for an example it's easier to just go through the entry method and just set the state explicitly, then at least it shows what you're actually doing. So in this example, I'm just creating a new bar entity and trying to change some properties and track the state throughout the example. So at the top here, I just create a new bar entity, give it a name. I create a context inside. First thing I ask is print out the current state. Then I say, well, now set its state to added. I print out the state again, I say save changes, I go out of the context, out of scope, I create a new context, and inside I just query the state of the same entity or the same object that was defined there. Afterwards I set the state to unchanged, which is actually just attaching the entity to the context. I print out state again. I just set the property of the entry of the entity, and then I print out state again. Now, this is always a good question to ask the audience what the outcome of such examples is, but I won't go through that. I just added the states on top of the example. So of course, if the entity is not known to the context, the state will be detached in both cases. Now, when you set it to added, luckily it becomes added. When you set it to unchanged, it becomes unchanged. And then here happens something special, because as you see, there's no proxying going on here. It's just a plain bar object. It was added to the database. Here it was attached again to the context. A property is changed, and still a context was able to track the state to modified from unchanged. Now, this is not something that happens to proxying, because the actual entity object is just the POCL object, and nothing special goes on there. So I'll explain the mechanism behind this a few slides further down. So then, why does the context need three different states for objects that are tracked and should not be deleted? So, well, you have an object in the context and the context knows about it. So why do you need so many different states? Well, actually, the added, unchanged and modified states, they just map one-to-one to the delete state map one-to-one to what the database should do with the entity. If it's added, an insert SQL statement should be generated. If it's modified, that will be an update. If it's unchanged, you don't have to touch the database at all. You can just leave it as is in memory. And if it's a delete SQL statement has to be generated. Now, I'm going to explain what goes on in the last state change in the example before. So what I had was, I had an entity in the unchanged state. I set its name property, and then it becomes modified. Now, that's really strange, because there's no tracking or proxying going on around the object. So what happens? And what happens is that the code first context actually keeps a snapshot of the original values from at the time the object becomes attached to the context. So not the original values in the database, but the values it had when you attach it to the context, when you set its state to unchanged. And then later on, it will compare those to the current values of the entity. So for example, what I did here is I created a context. I attached the entity. I asked the context for the entry corresponding to the entity, and then specifically for the name property. So well, this is also a fluent interface for retrieving such stuff. Now what I do is I print out the entity state before, like I did in the previous example. And then on top of that, I print out the original value, the current value, and the is modified flag on this thing. Then I change the name and I do the same thing again. And you'll see at first it's unchanged. The original value is equal to the current value, and is modified is of course false. Now, after I modify the name, you'll see that the state has changed to modified. The original value is still the same, but the new value has changed. And of course, is modified is also true now. So internally, the CTP5 keeps track of old and new values for each property. And that's the way the actual determination of the state is done. Now, to give a more elaborate example of what's going on inside the entity framework code first approach, is I tried to create a cocktail consisting of several components. So what I did, first two lines, they define two different amounts, one with quantity 1.8, one with quantity 1, which I'll use in a further example. I have three components, and then I create a new cocktail, a White Russian, and I add three cocktail parts. Note that because I didn't really provide any infrastructure for the collections, I even have to do the new of the list here myself, because otherwise, well, I can't use add, because then I'll get because then the value of cocktail parts would have been null. Now afterwards, I try to do something really simple on the code first context. I just say context.cocktails.add of this cocktail, I could also have set the state of the entry belonging to cocktail to edit in the same way I did before. And then I say context save changes. Now what's going to happen is that not only the cocktail will be persisted in the database, but it will also persist the cocktail parts, all three of them, and then the components and even the amounts attached to it. So what's so the same snippet at the top, just to give to send out a warning, is that well, you add the cocktail object to the context, but in fact it cascades every related entity it doesn't know about, which is nice because it's pretty easy to use. I just have one statement and the entire object graph is added to the context, which is also dangerous because it will allow certain operations to proceed which bypass validations. For example, if in the cocktail I add a new bar and then add a new cocktail and add a new bar, you will have sort of an object graph which will all be added at once. And this is obviously not what's wanted for security reasons, for example, in any real life application. So let's talk about proxies just a bit. So if you're working inside of your context and you ask for an entity, you won't actually receive an entity of the POCO type, of the simple class you defined yourself, but you'll receive a wrapped object. So you'll receive a proxy. And why is it proxied? It's just because you want to keep the relationship between your entity and the DB context, so that if lazy loading has to be performed on navigation properties, it can do so for you automatically. Now, there are some exceptions. If you declare your POCO classes in such a way that it's not allowed to create subclasses, or if you define your navigation properties as non-virtual ones, then of course the entity framework has no possibility to proxy those, and lazy loading just won't work. So manually disabling lazy loading for like one property is possible just by not declaring it virtual. And if you want it disabled globally, then there's also the option to just tell the DB context, well, don't do the lazy loading, or don't even do the proxying, and just expose the entities straightforwardly. So as a first example, I just created the object context. I asked for the first cocktail, which in my code, there was only one cocktail, but anyway, I have the C variable, which is the first cocktail. And then on the next line, I do something strange. I say, well, from the cocktail, I want the cocktail parts, and from the first part, I want the amount of entity. And from the amount entity, I'll set the name to one bottle. Then afterwards, I say to the context, well, I have this bar in a variable looks place. Just attach it to the context. So set its state to unmodified. And then I say to the cocktail entity, well, to your served at collection, so the set of bars where your served, just add this new bar you didn't know about. And then I say save changes. Now, what I want to demonstrate in this simple example is two things. First is lazy loading, because on the first line, I just say, well, from the cocktails, give me the first one. And then I have a cocktail object, but nothing else is retrieved. So not the cocktail parts, and certainly not for the cocktail parts, the amount. So what happens on the second line is I say, well, see cocktail parts first, amount name is one bottle. There, at least at two levels, the lazy loading occurs. Well, first, the cocktail parts are retrieved once I try to access them through the first call here. And then even if I have the first cocktail part, to get to the amount entity, another stage of lazy loading has to occur to get me that entity. And then I just set the name. And automatically all entities retrieved in between are tracked by the context and will be saved if their state is modified later on. Also, what I do here is I have the served at collection, which represents a many-to-many relationship. I just add an entity there, and automatically the many-to-many relationship gets updated. The reason the attach statement is there in between is because before that statement, the context doesn't know about the looksPlace bar variable. It doesn't know that entity. So if I would have added it without that line in between, the code first context or the DB context would think it's a new entity. So its state would be set to edit, And when I do a save changes, then a new entity will be created through an insert statement on the database instead of just creating the link between the existing bar entity and the cocktail entity. So actually leaving out the attached statement will cause the application to crash, because then we'll have a duplicate key, because I use GUIDs for keys and I had to set up those manually. Because the previous example was a bit like magic, I just say, well, you have the cocktail and then you take the parts and the first and the amount and you set it to something. It makes it appear to the audience that everything happens automatically. And of course, that's not the case. It still requires some good knowledge of the internals of the entity framework, and specifically this approach to write good code. For example, I could have said this outside of the context if I modify the served at collection and I just say, well, from now on, it's a list with one bar. Then I go inside of the context, and even if I say, well, the cocktail has been modified and the bar has been modified, but the relation in between is something I modified outside, then if I say a save changes, nothing's going to happen. So a minor drawback, or, well, not really a drawback, but a point of attention I see in working with these kinds of lazy loading and all automatic things is that it makes it appear from the examples you see on the web that everything is straightforward. But you have to keep in mind that internally is doing a lot of change tracking and tracking of the entities, that you can't really do everything. So it's important not to fall into the trap of believing that, well, we'll use this and it do everything for us, and then in the end you become a bit disappointed because not everything is possible, of course. So this is actually something fancy I still wanted to demonstrate from the CTP5. It's something that some people have missed in Entity Framework before. It's a loading of only a subset of a certain navigation property. So for example, what I'm trying to do here is I have a cocktail. I have the cocktail entity. It's tracked by the DB context. And what I want to do is I want to retrieve only the cocktail parts which have a quantity less than 0.5. So how can you formulate this query in the CTP5? Well, first of all, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to switch off lazy loading. Now, why am I doing this? Because if you keep it switched on, first time I'm going to access the cocktail parts navigation property is it might just trigger a lazy load and I'll still have all cocktail parts. So I switch off lazy loading. I retrieve the first cocktail in the set of all cocktails. Then I ask the context to give me the entry corresponding to that cocktail, and then the collection corresponding to the cocktail parts navigation property. From that, I create an object query object on which I can just use traditional link statements to specify which ones I actually want. So I say where cp.amount.quantity is less than 0.5. And then because I turned off lazy loading, I have to do the inclusion of the extra of the other two navigation properties from the cocktail part manually. So I say also retrieve components and amounts. And then finally I say load. And now if you would run this code, I didn't include the output in my slides, but if you run this code, you'll see only two of the three cocktail parts to be printed. So two steps. Actually, the actual thing of subquery loading is done in the orange parts, where you construct a query, do some querying using just link statements, and then in the end specify load. And then the red parts are in place to disable the lazy loading to interfere with the subquery loading we're trying to do here. So now we come to the final and conclusive part of this presentation. It's what I call the code first off-road, and it's related to some special things we tried to do in one of our projects to overcome the problem of cross EDMX references, as I called them before, and of extending entities which reside inside a binary distribution of a framework. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to first present some EDMX models, some very small ones, and then go to Visual Studio to just browse through some classes and give a small presentation. So I'm first going to present the example, the entities that exist in the example, and then I'm going to give a small demonstration. So the example consists of a restaurant's menu, which is maintained by three teams of developers. So one team of developer which is working on the soup, one team of developers is working on dessert, and the third team of developers is actually integrating everything together and also serving the main dishes. So I have three EDMX models. The first one is the one I call the soup model. And what I have at the right is a soup class with an ID and a name. And it just has a set of vegetables linked to it through a navigation property. And a vegetable is just an ID, a name, and a color. And the relationship is many to many because a vegetable can, of course, occur in multiple soups. And the soup can have multiple vegetables. Then for the dessert model, I have a dessert class which represents a dessert. It has an ID, a name, and I've assigned it a category. I'm not going to use the category, but I just wanted to have something in my EDMX models. There's a category added for dessert. It's a one-to-many relationship just to bring some variation in the object model. Then the third model is a third EDMX file, which I'll have in the demo. It's what I call the menu model. And a menu model has a menu class, which just has an ID, and then a navigation property, a set of dishes. And a dish is just an ID and a name. The relationship is many to many. Different menus can contain the same dish, and a dish can occur on multiple menus. And then also in the menu model, I've added something special. It's the delicious soup class, which I'll try to make a subclass of the soup class in the soup model later on. So actually the team of developers working on the menu model found that while the soup class wasn't sufficient, and an extra field, namely the special ingredient, has to be added there. And we'll try to do that also in the demo. So what I'm going to use inside the demo is the Ada.NET DB context generator D4 templates. Now those are shipped with CTP5, and what they do is they take your EDMX model, and from that they generate the POCO entities, and they also generate the DB context. Now what I did was, for the example, I have three EDMX files, as I mentioned before, one for dessert, one for the menu, and one for the soup. I have three D4 templates added for the model, and those have generated entity classes. I'll just quickly open some in the demo. And I've ignored the default generation for the DB context, because I want to do that. I want to set up that manually, because I need to make some references between the different EDMX files. So let me quickly go to Visual Studio for the second demo. So here you have my solution. At the right, you see three EDMX models. So the soup, menu, dessert. If I, for example, open the dessert entity, it's auto-generated class. It's a partial class dessert. It has an ID property of type GUID. It has a name property, and it has a navigation property to the dessert category. Now, for example, if I open the menu entity, you see it's a partial class menu. It has an ID and then just a set of dishes. Now, what I would like to do is, because a menu doesn't only consist of dishes, but you also want soup and you want dessert, I'll try to extend that. And how did I do that? I just added an extra class. Let me see. I called it menu.navigation.cs. It's actually just a random name. But because the menu is a partial class, I'm able to add more properties to it if I'd like. And what I just did was I said, well, the menu, it should also need an iCollection of soup, which I call soups. And then it should also need a dessert. No particular reason. I just wanted a collection and a simple property here just to create some difference. And then I also wanted the delicious soup class to be a subclass of the soup class. So I created deliciousSoup.baseClass.cs,
And this is even less exciting as the previous one. I just added this little piece back there. And then I just modified the soup class just a tiny bit. I modified the delicious soup class just a tiny bit. In that I commented out the generation for the ID property, because now it became a subclass and the original property wasn't virtual. So this can be overcome in an actual application setting by just modifying the T4 template just a tiny bit to either disable the generation of the ID property or to have it set to virtual as well in the base class. So on top of that, I have to sprinkle a bit of configuration to make everything work. So if I open the menu context, which is the DB context for this particular example, I have to specify some things manually. First thing is I have to specify that the relationship between soups and menu is many to many. Instead of by default, it would be many to one. So the menu class specifies a menu can have several soups. But if you would let the CTP5 code first do its automatic thing, it would say a soup has to belong to one menu. So I want to override that and I say, well, the menu entity has many soups, but the other side of the relation is also a many. Then the second line says, well, a soup has many vegetables, but also a vegetable can occur in many soups. Then further down, I just want to map the inheritance relationship. I say, well, the soup entity will go in the table soups, and then the delicious soup entity will go into the table delicious soups. And then last but not least, there's the really exciting demo application. What it does is it offers the user four options. You can create a database, drop the database, create two menus, and then just print the database context. Now the only exciting thing is the creation of the entities. You see, I create a few vegetables. I create a few soup entities, of which one is a delicious soup. So you see, here's the extra property that has been added in the menu model. Also mentioned that some vegetables occur in multiple soups. I created a few dessert categories, created a few desserts, created three main dishes, and then I created two menus and added the dessert and the dishes and the soups to them. Also notice some soups occur in multiple menus. I just say to the context, well, add menu one to the menus, add menu two to the menus, and then save the changes. And this is all it takes to actually create cross-references or navigation properties between different TDMX files, because of course in a real application setting you would like to have an EDMX model which is much larger than the one I described here. I just had two entities and any sane person would have put everything together into one file. But just to demonstrate the setting that you might have a framework binary somewhere lying around, you have an EDMX in there, it generates entities, you can't touch the EDMX anymore, but using this approach you can at least create navigation properties to those entities using the partial classes that are generated, and the context will still start up and you will still be able to go through the navigation properties and use everything as if it would have been in one EDMX file. So if I run this program, so I say one, create database. Okay, then I say three, create two entries. And now if I print them, what happens is you'll see two menus. Let me enlarge this a bit. Okay. So two blocks, two menus. First menu has the carrot soup and my soup in there, and then even the tomato soup. I also printed out a type to show you that inside of the context while printing, you don't receive actual POCO objects, but you receive some sort of proxy objects. That's why the name is actually the type, and then appended is some sort of GUID or ID representing that it's a dynamically generated proxy object. Also notice that the object types returns is one soup, one delicious soup, another soup. So the subclass thing is working correctly. This menu has two main dishes and a dessert. And the second menu only has two soups, one main dish and one dessert. So that's it for the demo. And actually that also concludes my presentation about the entity framework code first approach CTP5, which will be available as a release candidate later this month.